I realize I should have made sure I'm going to pronounce your name correctly. Is it Mellert?
It is Mellert.
Mellert, okay. It's not Meyer.
What? Did you just have a
Meyer.
seizure?
No. It's like a ridiculous like pseudo French pronunciation.
Oh boy.
I could see it.
It's actually German.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Okay. Here we go. Welcome everyone to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 363. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me as always are Guillaume Veillette.
Hello.
And James Jones.
I'm just a portrait of my normal self.
And John Lindemann is out today because of holiday. So we have in his place a first time ever substitute, Mr. Dave Mellert.
Hello, everybody. It is a pleasure and an honor to join these fine gentlemen today.
Ah, well, thank you very much.
We'll take care of that.
We'll see if it's still the case at the end of the episode.
It is a chore and an insult to be here.
All right, well, you guys have a challenge.
We run a real low-grade show here.
Right.
No, we are very happy to have Dave. He's a longtime RFN listener and recently joined the NWR staff, I guess sometime last year, was it?
Yeah, I've mostly been helping out with editing type stuff.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But Which we need.
I've done a couple of reviews and a couple of like blog posts.
Yeah. So we've run into Dave multiple times over the years at PAX East, and it's always been fun hanging out with him. I was excited when I heard that he was joining the staff. And when I found out I needed a substitute this week, I thought, well, it'd be great to get Dave on the show. So welcome, sir. We are going to get into some of your listener mails later in the show. We got tons
we got
of feedback
pounded
to last week's episode. It was really exciting for a few days. It was coming in so fast. It was like that was my favorite video game of the week, was like checking Twitter and the forums and the emails, because I really love seeing all that feedback. And I think it was not only the most feedback we've ever gotten on a single episode, but also probably some of the deepest and longest responses. I just think the average length of what people wrote.
It was very hard to read everything.
It was just like a volume, you know.
I'm still behind. So this will be
yeah, fun. And a lot of it, you know, almost all of it, I would say, very intelligent, very kind. You know, people, you know, of course there are people who disagreed with us, but I think most people at least appreciated our approach to it, or weren't completely turned off by it. I think we even picked up a couple of new listeners over at NeoGAF, and that I was actually particularly glad to see that community respond to it, because of course the data that we were using to launch into our discussion came from NeoGAF. It wouldn't have happened without the support of NeoGAF and
fault.
The NPDs. So. Yeah, right. Yeah, you can blame them. But the conversation over there was fantastic, as it was on our own side in the talk back and tons of Twitter. I really appreciate everybody who took the time to think about what we were discussing and to put your own spin on it and bring your own perspective to it and let us know, because I really enjoyed all of that. So we have probably a couple emails responding directly to that and a couple other about whatever else, but we'll get into that a little bit later in the show. And first up, as always, is new business, and James has the brand newest Wii U game.
Yeah, literally. Well, it could be the golf one too, I guess.
It came out yesterday.
Yeah.
Pretty
so
new.
I woke up late yesterday, watched the Nintendo Direct without any news spoilers, vomited all over Twitter, which is my normal Nintendo is doing a thing. Let's make fun of it on Twitter approach to gaming journalism.
How happy were you with the Direct?
It was weird. I mean, it was a strange Nintendo Direct because they had things to talk about, but it was like
obscure kind of odd things. Yeah.
And it's like, hey, we're gonna cut to Reggie for this weird North America only Bravely Default thing,
and then we're gonna talk about the microtransactions.
Yeah, we're gonna talk about the pay to win microtransactions, and then we're gonna cut back to Iwata, who should have been wearing a Santa hat. I'm deeply disappointed. we're going to cut back to talk about other random stuff, and then we're going to troll you with this Kirby Air Ride video that's actually Mario Kart, that's actually Smash Brothers. Which is why you will never be as good a troll as Sakurai is. And and then we had NES Remix, which is out right now. Go to your... We got Beyonce by NES Remix. It was weird.
So it's a Wii U eShop game.
It's a Wii U eShop game that is exactly what it sounds like. It is like...
I guess it's developed by the Game Center CX team. They made the game that we know in America as Retro Game Challenge, one of my absolute favorite Nintendo DS games.
I love that game. That game is awesome.
So here's what NES Remix is. It's essentially you get to play these really quick excerpts from classic NES games, where a lot of times, or as each time you play one, you unlock the successive stage that sort of increases the scope of the game in question, in reference. So a great example is Ice Climbers. Your very first Ice Climbers level that you play in there is something like Break a Block. And then you win, and there's a timer, and how fast you do it determines what score you get at the end. And then the next one may be Break Two Blocks. All right. Done. You win. The next one is climb to the second floor and break five blocks. Okay? And it sort of builds up, and then finally it's climb all the way to the top and jump on the bird.
And, which is basically Ice Climbers.
Right. But it may be like you have to do it three times with increasingly crazy levels like in a row, and you have a certain number of lives to get it in.
It almost sounds like a trainer for how to play these games.
A lot of times they are. And the thing is, towards the end, they start to get more difficult than the source material. So the games that I'm going to leave some out, but are like Donkey Kong for the NES, DK Jr. for some reason that I don't understand.
They play very differently.
They do. Super Mario Brothers, which I really don't understand. Super Mario Brothers, which is super not necessary. Mario Brothers is super not necessary. Super Mario Brothers is obvious. There's a really bizarre set of levels based on Zelda for the NES.
Bizarre in what way?
A lot of them revolve around the fact that how that game hides doors from you is stupid. It's just like, find the secret door, and you're like, where?
Just start burning every single bush until...
Pretty much. What it'll do is it'll put you on a screen, there'll be like four bushes, it'll say, find the secret door, and it'll circle it on the first one. And you only have one item, it's the the lantern. So you go over to the circle, and you throw the lantern, and so one of the bushes is circled, you use the lantern, the door's there. You go inside, and somebody says something dumb to you.
So do you think that this whole, like, teaching you how to play these games thing is tied to the fact that there's an eShop link that leads you not to downloadable content, but to buying these games that you're playing parts of?
Absolutely. But what's the bread and butter?
Okay, but if that's the main purpose for this thing to exist, why are they charging $15 for it up front? I think this thing would be a brilliant piece of like viral marketing for the virtual console if it was free to play, and it just basically promoted you to go and check out the real deals for $5 each.
Here's where the game gets more creative, though.
That would be one of the most evil and genius things Nintendo's done in a very long time.
As you collect, so you're scored with stars at the end of each day, just based on how fast you beat it. And as you collect stars, you unlock what are called the remix stages, which is where they take some element of these games that they've been, you know, training you on and just completely screw with it. So a good example is playing Donkey Kong as Link from the NES Zelda game, where he doesn't have any items. So he can't jump, because Link can't jump. He can't. So that means he can't use the hammers, which means you have to negotiate the barrels without getting hit or not being able to jump them. And his objective, instead of get to the top, is save the maiden.
Yeah, save the fair maiden.
So, yeah, save the fair maiden, or you'll get a...
Okay, but can you? What's the point of being Link? Can he use a sword? Can he throw the boomerang?
No, he just can't jump. Make it harder by making you Link, because Link has no jump animation in that game.
But does that really capture the joy of playing as Link?
No, it doesn't, but it's just a way of screwing with you in those remix stages. Or they'll switch Balloon Fight. They'll switch it to the Game Boy graphics for Balloon Fight halfway through it just to mess with you.
So James, I'm a little confused. What's the structure of this game like? Is it like a WarioWare kind of a thing?
It is. So at the very beginning, the only thing you can do is play the first remix stage, which is nothing really all that major. And that unlocks like five or six NES games that you can play through successively. So they all have, you know, their first level, and as you play each level, you unlock the next level in that game until you reach the last stage in that game. As you get stars playing those games or those levels, you unlock remixes. So remake, you know, it'll have a gatekeeping of, you know, 3 stars. This next one takes 10 stars and 15 stars. And then as you play those and you unlock those, you continue to press on, you eventually unlock a second set of remixes and eventually additional games to get more stars. So you can basically pick wherever you want to go as long as you've unlocked that level individually.
Okay.
It's not like WarioWare where they serve them up to you successively in one, you know, gameplay session. You, after each stage, you pick the next stage you want to do.
So some of the more interesting, I guess, in my mind, content is kind of gated behind finishing some.
Yeah, it is. It is. Now, the thing is, a lot of these stages, like, they take 17 seconds, 12 seconds, okay. 10 seconds. Because it'll be something like, climb to the second stage, okay? Or it'll be like in Hammer Brothers, is that it?
Wrecking Crew?
Wrecking Crew, that's it. It'll be like, break the
Hammer
wall.
Hammer Brothers would be a good alternate title for that, actually.
It'll be break the wall, and there's one wall there. You're like, all right, done. Or that'll be, you know, break.
Is this fun? I mean, it sounds like you're doing very, like, rudimentary pieces of these games.
Fun.
And these games are already so simple. I feel like, you know, at least in Wrecking Crew, there is kind of a strategy to it. And there's a level design that you have to negotiate. And when you kind of take some of those things out and you just boil it down to the very simplest mechanic, I find it hard to believe that still really captures the entertainment value of the original
really
work.
It really depends on the NES game. So Wrecking Crew is a good example because the first few, they're really, really basic. They're just, you know, they're telling you how to play the game. And they're showing you, you know, some walls you have to hit more than others. There are bombs. You don't want to get hit by the possessed demon wrenches, stuff like that. But later Wrecking Crew stages are legitimate. They're really riffs on what Wrecking Crew does. They're stages that you have to do puzzle solving for. And it's sort of like a real quick run through the Wrecking Crew sort of paradigm of level design. So some of the ones at the end are really hard. Some games aren't that much fun. Pinball is completely useless.
I actually like that game.
The last NES pinball challenge is so dumb because it's just score 10,000 points.
So what I wonder though, I mean, I could imagine maybe a remixed version of that would be fun, but you know, would anyone put in the time playing that game to get to the remix version?
I think that the game taps into your desire to get shiny stars all over the place. Like, it grades your performance,
right?
One to three stars, and if you do like flawlessly, then you get an even special rainbow thing.
And there's like a cheering crowd. It's all psychological warfare.
Yeah. So these very, very simple tasks can become really, really tough when you're going against a timer, right? And when you're trying to execute it flawlessly.
Right. So, especially when they give you a bunch of them in succession. So this stage may be like 5 tasks where you're effectively doing the same thing, but the area in which you're acting is becoming increasingly perilous. So balloon fight, you may be like, pop 3 balloons. All right. The first one is just 3 balloons hanging out. Then it's pop 3 balloons and now there's some birds flying around. Then it's pop 3 balloons and it's just chaos everywhere. And they're all served to you, bang, 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 one right after another. So there's a certain, like, okay, what are they going to do next time? Oh, game, why? And suddenly you're on a screen that's completely covered in lightning sparks.
Okay, so James and Guy, I know you've both been playing this, and it's taken us a while to even really explain what the hell it is.
It's super weird.
Nintendo didn't try that hard, it sounds like, either.
No.
I have a question for you guys. I mean, I haven't bought this yet, and I'm pondering it, and I wanted to hear from you guys for sure, and probably look for some additional reviews and coverage as well. But I guess for me, the big turnoff is I don't actually like a lot of the games that make up the collection that they're remixing here. So my question for you guys is, do you feel like the format and the structure that they're bringing to this package makes those games more fun and maybe more appealing to someone even who doesn't like those games in the first place? Or do you think maybe it's a good idea to kind of throw this package together, but it would be very contingent upon the appeal to you personally of those collections? In other words, should I maybe consider holding out for like a volume 2 that would be a little bit later games from the NES library or even go into Super NES or something like that?
I would say that you don't have... I've played about 3 to 4 hours. I mean, I did a 2-hour shot when I first got the game because I was trying to rush through it, in part because maybe we'd need someone to review it, and maybe because, I mean, I didn't have anything to do this week anyway. And it was... There were games that I really don't like, and because mm-hmm. most of these are really, really early NES games, like pre-1990.
Pre-1988, I think. Oh,
yeah, in many cases. So
a lot of these are the black box launch games.
Yeah, oh, you're right. In America. So what you end up with are games that have just terrible jumping.
Yeah.
So Ice Climbers.
Like Ice Climbers.
Oh. Yeah. Ice Climbers jumping is repellent. Mario Brothers jumping is just beyond what should be considered acceptable even in a virtual console game.
In both those games, you go through platforms when, you know, like the edge of the platforms when you jump diagonally.
And you can't move in the air in either of them, even though what they're asking you to do almost requires it. It's really unpleasant. But in other
particular,
games,
I don't think NES version of Mario Brothers is a very good version of that game even. I remember I didn't even like that game until I probably played it in the arcade at some point. I found an old arcade cabinet of it, and I was like, oh, wow, this is actually kind of fun. I guess this is, you know, why people actually liked this game back in the day, because I always thought the NES version was horrible.
Oh,
and
it's
then
bad.
The GBA version that came with all those, you know, Mario Advance repackagings that they did, those are basically, you know, like classic retro remakes, but I always thought that version was really fun, and especially the versus aspect of it. I got to try it a few times, and it was really, really fun to do on GBA. That was long after the original.
So, the thing is, there are other things to do. Like, the Zelda stages are legitimately amusing. They sort of have a certain amount of, like, WarioWare's 9-volt stages, too. I mean, that's a lot of what this is. It's like playing a bunch of the 9-volt stages in WarioWare.
Yeah, so, which I've always thought are fun, mainly because I like the aesthetic difference between those levels and all the other things going on in WarioWare. But you know,
it's a little bit too much to take in. The remix stages can be fun just because of the sense of, okay, what are they going to do to me this time?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, maybe it's you're playing, you know, level 1-2 of Super Mario Brothers, but backwards, and your objective is to get to the flagpole. Well,
it's like a ROM hack or even, I don't know if you guys remember, but back in like the days of Game Genie, sometimes there were codes that actually made the game harder.
Yes.
And I guess I never really felt like using those. I thought it was more fun to use the ones that gave you weird powers and kind of broke the game.
Infinite jumping. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the thing is, it's the whole level, but it's flipped. Even your score or the name of your player is reversed up at the top. But what'll happen is, so you're like, oh, well, I'm going to just run across the top of the level because I remember how to do this. Well, your objective is get to the flagpole. You get to the warp zone. You go in the warp zone. It says, failed. Because you didn't get the flagpole.
I actually really like that.
It's stuff like that.
Where you got to follow directions, man.
There's little jokes in some of these levels that are actually really kind of amusing. And you think, oh, that's
clever.
That's fun. And it's when the game does stuff like that that it's rewarding.
That's a pretty elaborate joke, actually, for a ROM hack.
The game has an amusing sense of humor. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, that can carry a game. There's a good Mario stage where they've completely covered the ground in ice. Yeah, you know, Mario's already really floaty on the ground in that game. And there's no ice mechanics in Super Mario Brothers. But if you add that, oh my god, he's uncontrollable.
Yeah, and Mario's actually skating.
I was going to say, he doesn't move his legs, so he just stands on one foot and it looks like he's skating.
It's a nice variety of ways they've played with the games, the source material.
Yeah, it's really, really weird because I don't like Mario Brothers on the NES. I don't like Ice Climber. And I'm still playing these minigames, you know. I don't have to, but I am. And I'm not sure if I'm actually, you know, having fun or if I'm just trying to prove something. Like, oh, come on, two stars, I'll show
you. Just grinding achievements.
It's like a score attack, but it's like a speed attack. It's really strange. I would say if you watch a video of somebody playing and not just video of it being played, but, you know, them talking about what they're seeing. There's a decent one that I think it was IGN put up where you can watch somebody playing it and talk about it also while laughing at how terrible they are at it. But it's you can kind of get a really good feel for what the game is doing, which is really stupid that they didn't do that, because just seeing it in action, I think it makes a lot of sense what this game is. you guys have to keep in mind that the remix stages are only like a seventh of the game. There is other stuff there, but it's a lot of it's so fast to work through, it's kind of a moot point. You know, I cleared the Donkey Kong and Donkey Kong Jr. stages probably in a combined, with maximum number of stars, maybe 10 minutes. I mean, real quick, just real fast, real work through them real quick. So it's not hard to unlock the remix stages, it's just you have to keep in mind that other stuff exists. And they didn't do a good job describing that on the Nintendo Direct.
And it has some kind of like score comparison system, doesn't it? I mean, ideally, the goal of the game wouldn't be necessarily to unlock everything, but it would be to really master the stuff and compete with your friends.
Right, but the only way that you're competing is, you know, posting your score on Miiverse. It's not... There's no leaderboards.
Miiverse posts actually list their time down there. Unfortunately, like, I had one, I just cannot... The last Legend of Zelda one, it just says, find a secret passage and enter. And it gives you, like, 2.5 minutes to find it. And I have not found the stupid secret passage yet. I've burned every pixel of the ground, and I cannot find it. And I just feel like a complete dolt. But at the same time, one of the earlier ones is buy something. That's your objective. You're just told buy something, and you're in the shop, but you don't have enough money. You're 5 rupees short. And the cheapest item is circled. And if you go outside and hunt for rupees, you won't find any. Maybe you find one. The trick
is like a nightmare.
The trick is you have to just keep looking, and there's another shop down the road that's selling cheaper items that you can already afford.
Oh, wow.
And you're just like, oh, screw you, game!
Yeah, I mean, I see what you mean by the sense of humor. I mean, even after all this, I really still don't know what I think of this.
I'm really enjoying it, and we're having... I don't want to give too much away for internal site discussions, but it coming out last night, the same day we had our Game of the Year discussions going on, blew up everything.
Really? I'm not sure I'm in love with it, to be honest. I do think it's more fun to experience these games this way instead of actually buying Ice Climber and playing that. But
because Ice Climbers is repellently terrible.
Yeah, and it doesn't make the game awesome to be playing Ice Climber in NES Remix.
It gives you a very small bite size of the gameplay.
Yeah.
You feel like I understand how Ice Climbers is played now, because I've played this progression of break a block all the way to climb 3 successive stages in a row of increasing complexity.
Is learning to play Ice Climbers something that I was hoping to achieve in my lifetime? Not particularly.
No,
but the thing is, it's done in 10 minutes. So
okay, well, fair enough.
To get back to an earlier question, I mean, is this game worth $15 then?
Yeah, I do think that it would have been easier to swallow at a cheaper price.
I think it probably should have been $10.
Yeah,
it actually would be really nice since it's using games that I probably would never buy on Virtual Console for the most part. It'd be really nice if you bought this game for $15 and then it gave you a discount on the Virtual Console links
that it sends you off to
for the constituent games. Then it would be like a sampler, and you could say, you know what? I never realized that I really enjoy Wrecking Crew. And now that I actually understand how to play it, because of course these old games don't teach you how to play them at all. But now that I kind of get the cycle that you go through to play the game properly, now I want to go get some more of that, and here's $1 off or whatever.
I will say the way this game is packaged, and not just how the interface is put together and stuff, just how these games look, they look remarkably sharp for NES games.
Actually, some of them must have some sort of filter on them, especially Mario.
These aren't the ROMs. These are recreated.
Right.
Somebody's gone in and rebuilt these levels' graphics.
Because the sky in Super Mario Brothers goes from light blue to darker blue.
Oh, yeah, it's got gradients. And in Super Mario Brothers,
shadows.
Yeah, that's a really funny one, is that everything in Super Mario Brothers projects a shadow onto the background as if the sky is just a backdrop.
Yeah.
It's weird.
It's a nice
visual effect, but it actually looks kind of cool.
Yeah.
It's hard to say if it's worth it. I think I'm personally not upset with the money I spent. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, me neither, but I buy everything, so...
Yeah, I'm a much pickier sell.
All right. Well, that was educational. Not an easy game to talk about, but definitely worthwhile, and I'm glad we got it out there while it's still brand new. So let's move on to Guillaume with a few first impressions of Zelda.
Oh, okay. Yeah, sure. I picked up Zelda a while ago, but I hadn't been able to touch it,
really.
A Link
Between Worlds.
A Link Between Worlds.
Just to clarify, not Wind Waker or anything else.
Good point. because I still haven't played, you know, Skyward Sword or anything, so it could have been that. But no, I really love 2D Zelda games, and this looked, you know, like right up my alley, and I could not wait, except that I did wait because of Ace Attorney, which was also excellent.
So what do you mean you could not wait?
So, yeah, I'm really liking the game. The game really plays great. I'm not sure, I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of bosses, but I'm not sure, James, if your claim that there's only two new bosses in the game is correct. I'm not recognizing most of these. There's of course the worm, the one that you hit the tail of, and you know that's in every Zelda game. But other than that, I fought like some weird set of spinning plates, or I don't know.
Like that in other Zelda games. They may not visually look the same, but they're the same mechanic.
Hmm. Anyway, I haven't fought that many bosses actually, but from what I've seen, I think they're pretty new, and more importantly, I think that they take way more hits than previous bosses. You know, it's not just hit three times or anything like that. Like I really have to wail on these guys.
That worm boss in Link to the Past was a nightmare. That thing took a lot.
Well, because he knocked you off down to a lower level, and you had to go back up.
Am I just going to start telling you guys to get good? Because I'll do it.
I found him significantly easier in this version. Way easier than Link in the Past.
He's super easy.
Yeah.
He takes a lot of hits, but he's not really dangerous, which is weird.
You know, I do think it's... I would have liked a completely new overworld. Because there is certainly a sense that, okay, I've seen this before, and I kind of know where I'm going, and I kind of know where the secrets are going to be. But at the same time, like, you enter a cave, and instead of just being a small room where you find some rupees or a chest or something like that, you get these really elaborate kind of either puzzles or kind of action scenes or something like that. I had one instance where I entered a cave and I had to grab a cuckoo by the feet and then glide my way down and avoid air currents to try to catch all the rupees. And it's not something that I expected. Like, this is really new to this game. It's kind of a weird mix between 3D Zelda and 2D Zelda, and I really enjoy it. But
some of them are almost like platforming.
Yeah, absolutely. And many of them are just like, okay, use your wall fusing ability to just try to make your way to this chest. And that it's much more of a puzzle. So I enjoy those, but because they're new, and I would have liked seeing even more new. I understand that making a whole new Zelda with a whole new overworld would probably have meant, you know, that we wouldn't be playing this right now. But, you know, like, despite the fact that it's reusing the overworld, I'm still very happy with it. And I'm just addicted to collecting everything. The fact that you get so many items right away means that you don't have to wait until the end of the game to grab this one piece of heart, you know. There are some items that will elude you until pretty much the end, because there are some items that you get only through dungeons, that you only get through the normal progression through the dungeons. But overall, like, it's way quicker. It feels like, okay, I'm entering this area for the first time, and it feels like the first time that I enter it, I can actually clear it of any secrets. And that's kind of a cool feeling to have in a Zelda game.
Yeah. Less backtracking, which you would think James would appreciate, but no.
No,
because it's not challenging at all. It's baby's first Zelda, so no.
I don't know. There have been a few stumpers for me.
I'm sorry.
I don't know. I've played a couple of Zelda games, and yet, like, there are a couple of things here that I didn't find immediately obvious. Perhaps because I wasn't used to this wall morphing ability. You know, like, there are places Like, if I have a tip for people, it's really, like, look at the map when you're in dungeons, because you might find yourself really stupid once you figure out why you're not finding the one key that you're missing to open the door. And, oh, okay, I had to go outside and go around the wall, and there was this ledge here.
Well, of course, and in this game, you always have the map. You don't have to go look for it. It's just when you walk in, I think it pretty much shows you the full outline, doesn't it?
Yeah, right, The rooms are kind of grayed out, or you don't see the details of rooms until you enter them. But once you enter them, you see everything you need to know.
But you can still see basically the structure of it. And, I kind of like that. And I think it's a good idea. You know, when you're dealing with a 3DS game, you do have that second screen. You might as well just let people use it. Because even, like you said, even learning to use the map, even when you don't have to go seek it out, it still takes a while to get used to doing it. And it's possible to not use that map very well. So I like that they're just kind of making that part of the game now rather than a bonus item that sort of makes things easier.
Yeah. And there's a couple of things that, I don't find especially challenging, but that are still new to this game, I think. Like the last dungeon that I played today was the one in the Lost Woods in the Dark World. And you have, you know, the classic hand that descends from the ceiling and grabs
you. The Wall Master.
Yeah, the Wall Master. But this time, it can actually activate switches, or it can kill enemies for you, and you have to use that to get through the dungeon. And it was kind of obvious just from the way that the level is designed that that's what they wanted you to do, because, oh, okay, like, there's two enemies up there, and I can't do anything against them, but there's the wall master that's always coming down. Okay, maybe I should try that. And then, you know, that's the solution. You know, like, it's a new twist on an old Zelda trope.
And it also uses the 3D, not only the 3D visual effect of playing it on the Nintendo 3DS, but it brings a sense of depth and elevation to the world, which is one of the of subtle themes of the entire game. You know, you go back to, and that creature, the Wallmaster, has been around since the original Legend of Zelda on NES. But never before in any Zelda game would you have thought to put a switch between you, in other words, to get under something so that the Wallmaster will come down from above and hit a switch that's between the two of you. Mm-hmm. And I think it's such a great idea. And it's using one of the oldest enemies in the entire franchise in a completely new way.
Yeah. And I love the verticality of the game. Like, there's so many, the mountain of Mount Doom. Is that what it's called? Or am I, you know, is that Lord of the Rings? Anyway, Death Mountain.
Death Mountain, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you go in these mines, like this ore mine, and you go in the cave, and you're way, way, way up, and there's magma at the bottom, and there's these moving platforms, and you have to make your way down, but they're moving, and you have to jump from one to the next as both of them are traveling. And it's pretty cool, you know? It's not something that we've done in Zelda before. It puts the 3D to really great use.
I agree. I'm glad you like it. I thought that you would. And it's good to have a little more counterweight against James. Have you played it, Dave?
I have not. I'm looking forward to playing it over Christmas break.
Yeah.
That'll be a good time.
So what other games do you have lined up for Christmas break? Because you'll be done by about day two.
See, James, there's nothing that you can say that would turn me off of playing that game.
I'm suggesting you should have additional plans because you'll need them.
Yeah, there's always plenty to do.
It's not a game we could guarantee that everyone will like, clearly, but I do think it's a game everyone should give a chance. Yeah. I don't know if James would agree with that, but I think
I'm not saying people shouldn't play it. I'm saying it's not great.
It's worth figuring out whether you will enjoy it, and by you I mean the listener. So give it a try if you get a chance. But we need to move on in new business, and let's hear from our guest, Mr. Mellert.
All right. So first, just a little bit of background. I've had a really hectic work schedule over the past 6 months or so. So a lot of work, a lot of stress, not a whole lot of time for leisure. So I've really had to kind of focus and pare back my gaming. And I really wanted to look for a game that I could play in short bursts, and something that, you know, more importantly, would be fairly low stress.
Oh, so Dark Souls?
The exact opposite of Dark Souls, actually. So I picked up, for the very first time, an Animal Crossing game. I picked up New Leaf.
Hmm.
And it's a game that I'd never really considered in the past. It never sounded appealing to me, the way that it was described. But, you know, just through street passes and word of mouth and podcasts and so on, a lot of people were playing this game. So I thought, okay, I'll give this a try. It sounds like exactly the kind of game that I need right now. So I picked it up in August, and I've been playing it ever since. I think it perfectly scratched the itch of what I was looking for.
I get the feeling that discovering Animal Crossing as you're, you know, traversing a really stressful period and, you know, like in university or at work is, you know, what really makes you love the game. Like, I was, you know, I was going through like my first real work experience when I played the GameCube one, and I was just like, oh, it's so nice to come back home and play this.
It's great. And there's so many different things to do. I mean, I probably don't have to explain Animal Crossing to people, right?
I think you would struggle to do so if you need to.
I think it's a really interesting choice, Dave, for your situation, because I guess I've always seen Animal Crossing as being a game for people with way too much time on their hands. Mm-hmm. And I don't say that derisively, because there's plenty of people who just have a lot of leisure time, you know, and they want a game that can chew through 200 hours of their lives over the period of 6 months.
But real people like me changing the world don't have time for this bullshit. putting people in space. You're fucking farming apples.
No, all I'm saying is, for me, if I'm, you know, I have periods where I'm super busy and periods where things slow down a little bit. But if I'm extra busy and extra stressed out, when I play games on the very limited time that I have to do it, I want something a little dense and more concentrated, and that I can kind of get that satisfaction of, you know, accomplishing something in a video game in the shortest amount of time possible. And Animal Crossing is, to me, the opposite of that. You have to play it for a very long time to really build up to the kind of in-game accomplishments that are ostensibly the goal of playing it.
Yeah, I think the beauty of the game is that it really allows for both styles of play. And I have to be honest, there is a draw there to do this, you know, rush to the finish, this sort of min-maxing kind of situation. Okay, how can I make the most bells in the least amount of time? And, you know, I've gone on the internet and looked and figured out how to do that, and I know how to do that.
But that kind of, I don't know, that defeats the purpose of the game, no? Sometimes, like, it's cool to just take things at their own pace, and sometimes teaching a villager a filthy word is its own reward.
I completely agree. And basically what I've done out of necessity more than anything is just said, you know what, I'm just going to play for a little bit each day or every other day. And by the way, the ability to change the town ordinances so that you can shift it to your schedule, or even set up the town so it doesn't grow weeds or fall into ruin if you can't play it for a while. My understanding is these are new features in the game.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that they're brilliant. Without them, I don't think I'd have been able to enjoy the game as much as I have.
I think they're almost like accessibility aids. I mean, I think they're very, very smart features, because they allow that game to be enjoyed by groups of people who really could not have before, you know, because of their work schedule or because of the frequency with which they are able to get in there and play a session of it. I think it really lets you tailor the game a little bit more to the way that you need to be able to fit it into your life, you know? Animal Crossing, just to follow up a little bit, because I haven't talked about the game in months and months and months, and this was also my first Animal Crossing. And honestly, after about the first 2 months, I really haven't played it at all. And in that period of time, I wasn't playing it heavily, but I would check in every day or two and play for at least 5 or 10 minutes, and sometimes for longer. And, you know, I definitely feel like I spent my time with it to get a sense of what it's like. I mean, a lot of people would probably look at the amount that I've played and say, well, you know, you really have to play it for 50 hours before it completely hooks you. You know, I mean, they'll go into this, Monster Hunter kind of formula. And obviously I don't think that's a legitimate viewpoint, in the sense that I think a game has to grab you a little more quickly than that. And, you know, for me, I think I confirmed my suspicion that it's not really a game for me, but I also felt that I got smarter on what people do find appealing about it. And I think I appreciate, if I don't appreciate the game so much or the series, I at least appreciate why other people get so into it. And I feel like I can at least sympathize with that a little bit more. And it's not going to be on my top five of the year. I got to tell you that. And I'm sure it would be number one for a lot of people. Like I know people who just got hopelessly sucked into it. And it sounds like you were a more casual player, Dave, at least relatively speaking. But for me, it was like I was dabbling and I always knew that. And I finally decided, you know, I feel like I'm probably going to play this enough to get my $40 out of it. And I probably did, you know, especially as a learning experience and as sort of a cultural experiment for myself, just to try the series that I've been hearing about for so long. And I think that will probably be my final Animal Crossing game, but I don't regret it.
You know, I recommend diving back in just a little bit because, you know,
to see the wasteland that was once your village.
Yeah, well, it turns into Fallout 4 when you turn it back on after 6 months.
Well, no, because I think it was a week or two ago, maybe even longer than that now, when Nintendo finally got Miiverse up and running on 3DS through an update.
Oh, yeah, and I'm seeing a lot of people diving back into the game just to take pictures and sharing them.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. It adds kind of a social aspect to it that wasn't really there before. I mean, you could make friends and things, but it was really cumbersome. And it's just kind of nice now to, hey, here's this thing that I can take a picture of, some crazy, you know, snowman configuration that I have built or this weird outfit that I put together. You know, it sounds really silly, but it's kind of cute, a lot of fun. and I've been happy. You know, I wouldn't say that I've done much more than dabbled either, but I've kind of continuously dabbled over time. And yeah, I'm still really enjoying it. Cool. You know, that's not to say that I don't have, you know, Super Mario 3D World and haven't been playing the heck out of that.
So I've got one game this week. It's nothing super exciting probably, but figured I would just give a few quick thoughts on E7.
Holy shit, E7?
E7, yeah.
Yeah, they're up to 7, Guillaume.
No, he's like, oh, it's not exciting. Like, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Terrible
I don't think
joke.
It's that exciting.
Carry on.
Yeah, Guillaume's got to work on your delivery.
Yeah.
I don't
make
think
it
it's
sound
that
like somebody just dropped something on your foot, didn't quite get it get off what we're going for.
Well, I know you did play through this game.
That's how you should have delivered it.
So, Guillaume, I know you played through this game a while back and talked about it and enjoyed it quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. I had to go at it like in I took a long, long break between like the first half and the second half of the game.
Oh, right.
It gets repetitive. But
is it actually divided in halves, or is it just you just said, all right, this is my stopping point?
Well, at some point, like there's four main areas to the world, if I recall correctly, and so you find four, you know, MacGuffins, and then yep. Oh, there's four more. Go
oh,
back to
sake.
These areas. So I thought, oh shit, they just want me to re-explore the same dungeon that I just went into. But no, like
when you were there last time, you totally missed this thing.
Yeah, but no, like it opens up new areas that are in the same, you know, basic themes like water and fire and jungle or whatever the settings are. But they're new areas with new challenges. So if Johnny, you know, if you get to that point, you're like, oh, okay, I've seen everything to the game. No, don't.
Sure.
There's more to it.
Okay, good to know. I'm still fairly early, so I'm not even really aware of the structure that you just described, but I think I probably am coming up to the first of the major dungeons. I've been playing the game for about 6 hours, so I think it's probably taken a little too long to get to this point, and that's probably my big criticism of the game. It just gets off to a really slow start, and they dump you into this giant town, and you have no idea where to go. And in order to proceed past the opening segment of the game, you have to trigger this scripted event that involves like talking to people in a certain order and going back to a place that you've already been to before, and then trying to leave. And before something finally triggers, and it's just way too complicated. I actually had to go to GameFAQs to figure out how to get out of the first town,
yeah,
which
it's
is not,
good. Not
a good sign.
No. There's way too much dialogue, and it's not very interesting, and so many NPCs, and you have to talk to them. Yeah, like, it's not a good start at all.
It's kind of a hard departure from what we've originally done as Ease on the show, which is just run around and run things over like you're a lawnmower. It's fine.
That's one of my favorite things, you know, when we did the retroactive on Ease Book 1 and 2, which is the first two games combined. I loved how just quickly you get right into the action, and
it seemed to have no regards for its own plot whatsoever.
And that whole game is just at turbo speed, you know. So
especially if you put it in turbo speed,
which I did, and I love playing it that way. I really do. I love the kind of hyperactive feeling of it, and the feeling that you're moving through enemies and plowing through these dungeons and gaining levels at just really, really fast pace. And I love that feeling. And E7 is completely lacking in that regard, which is a big disappointment to me. Yeah, I think so. But, you know, once you get out on the field, which is where the action takes place, it is fun. It is engaging. I do think it's pretty repetitive, but there's something kind of dumb and fast-paced about it that I enjoy. And they're kind of hinting at maybe there will be some kind of strategy to the combat as the game progresses. So far, it's been incredibly simple. But I just got the third character in the party, and you can only control one at a time. But it does give you more options, at least, when you have a larger party. And then the AI sends them around, and they are somewhat effective, I guess, on their own. But
you need to switch between them, and it's kind of instantaneous, right? You press a button and suddenly you're the other character, and there's like three types of damage. There's like a basher, you know, bashing damage. There's the sword slicing, and there's usually someone with some sort of projectile, and you have to use the projectiles against the flying enemies. You have to use the bashing against the armored enemies, and so, you know, and you do significantly more damage when you match the right type of weapon with the right enemy.
It's not so much a bonus as a requirement, because if you use the wrong type, you will do practically no damage at all. So it's, you know, mandatory, but it gives you something to do other than just mash on the button, and it does add a little bit of tactics to it. So I'm fine with that, but you know, the game, it doesn't seem really it doesn't seem to take a whole lot of brain power to blast through it, but I kind of felt that way about the first one too, other than the dungeon maps being ridiculously complicated. And that's, I don't think, the case anymore. So, you know, it's a PSP game. I'm playing it on my Vita. It looks fine. It looks kind of like a PS2 game, I guess. So it's not like super nice looking by today's standards, but I still think it looks fine. And there's actually a brand new Ease game out on Vita that is pretty impressive from a presentation standpoint. It's been getting good reviews, but I don't know a whole lot about it yet.
It seems to be a continuation of E7. It seems to be the same kind of gameplay, the same three characters that you switch between, and like very
similar
much in the
systems.
Same thing.
Which
but
is
yeah,
cool.
Like it is, you know, like it is simple, but you can't keep playing just like. You can't keep just using the main weapon, continually hitting A against the enemies, because eventually, if you want to keep doing that, like, you're going to have to level up incredibly, or you're going to have to start using more the parry system, and because you can block against attacks when you press L and R at the same time.
Oh, I haven't even been taught that yet.
Oh, okay. And it's easy to miss. I think I was taught it, and then I forgot about it. And then I had to learn how to play the game by going on GameFAQs or whatever. Like, you have to do that, and it fills up a gauge that allows you to unleash a special attack. And there are other types of special skills that you can level up, and they've got their own gauge. So, yeah, it gets a little bit more complex.
How much does the game explain of that itself?
Explain it, but it's gradual.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it's not super obtuse or anything, but that stuff, some of that stuff is buried into other walls of text that you're already tired of paging through
early
in the game.
Just hammering through.
Yeah. So, okay, well, that's good to know. It sounds like there might be a little more depth to the combat than I've seen so far, which is promising. I'm enjoying it so far. I do prefer Oath and Fel'Ghana, which is the sort of remake of Ease 3. And that game, I just felt like got off to a better start. You know, it's a long game, so by the time I work through more of it, maybe I won't mind as much. And I just kind of wanted to throw it out there. It's a game I picked up recently on a crazy PlayStation Store sale. And I'm playing it on my Vita because I never had a PSP, so I'm catching up with it. It's the, you know, I haven't played a lot of the Ease games. Some of them are really hard to get your hands on. But this one, because you had recommended it, Guillaume, I figured I would give it a shot. And I don't quite know what to think so far, but I'm going to definitely keep playing it.
Cool.
Yeah, I have a lot of other Vita games to catch up on over the holidays, but I'm definitely going to keep trying this one, and hopefully it will grab me soon and kind of pull me through for the rest of it. All right, well, that is going to have to wrap up new business, and we're going to take a break. When we come back, we've got your listener mail. I hate doing that right after I just did my new business.
Well, there's not a
natural break in between.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First this week, we have Powered Off, Issue 12. It's all RFN all day for Issue 12. Johnny and John get their hands into the staff profile game, but don't try to friend Johnny on Miiverse. He's full. I took a pretty picture and wrote 1,300 words about it. You can just smile and nod.
So the Powered Off, James never actually says what the hell it is. It's the PDF magazine, which you know, has a mixture of archive content from our site as well as original stuff, including James's monthly article. So I hope you'll check that out.
My monthly screed.
Yeah, download it to your brand new tablet this holiday season.
If you didn't get a tablet, your parents don't like you.
We also have a review of NES Remix for the Wii U by Don Koopman. James and Guy spent 30 minutes trying to describe NES Remix and were somewhat unsuccessful. Maybe Don will have more luck. He loves remixing NES classics.
There you go.
And there's also an editorial on the Nintendo Direct from this week called Planting the Seeds of Concern. Yikes. This one's by Alex Calafi. So as we've covered, Nintendo had a very unique set of announcements in their most recent Nintendo Direct. As you can see from the title, Alex clearly feels good about it. Actually, he has very strong feelings about Luigi's Mansion diorama prices.
We have impressions. Donkey Kong Country Tropical Freeze for the Wii U by Aaron Kaluska. Aaron got his hands on Cranky Kong's staff. James. So you can read about that. We have lots of new details as well, but we know you all want to know what's up with the oldest Kong and his Pogo staff.
Okay, and we have an interview with Bill Trinan about National Street Pass Weekend by Curtis Bonds, Justin Baker, and Kimberly Keller. Basically, everyone on staff got the rare opportunity to interview Bill Trinan.
It's hard, okay?
You should read that. He is important. You can also see how he teases Miiverse and Street Pass integration, and perhaps Wii U.
And then says that's not actually under development.
Not yet.
He is important.
But we do have some kind of game of the year type feature articles going up around this time of year, so I hope you will go check those out as
Hopefully
well.
Hopefully next week after this comes out.
Yeah. Sometime over the break, we'll have that kind of content going up and lots of other stuff as well. So go check those out over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It is time for listener mail. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And James is going to read the first email this week.
Pete writes, I work as a Linux sysadmin, and our shifts are arranged so we work 3 and 4 12-hour days, alternating weekly, and get the rest of the week off. It also means that by the last day, I'm dead tired. 12 to 15-hour sleep sessions are common for that last day. I say that because I started playing Super Mario 3D World at 9 a.m. when I got home after my week shift was over. At about 11 p.m., I had to explicitly tell myself that it was time to go to bed, because I had been playing for roughly 14 hours and had been awake for roughly 36. I didn't even feel the slightest bit tired, but my analytical side had to take over for my health's sake. It's fun. It's the most fun I've had playing a game like that in a decade. There's no epic scope, there's no grand uber challenge, it's just fun, in a way that I haven't gotten out of a game in over a decade. I'm disappointed it took a system sales apocalypse to wring this much fun out of Nintendo. It's not my game of the year, it's my game of the goddamn decade, trademark. I know you guys will eventually play it. I'm just saying that there's no need to dread having to plow through when you get there. Right.
So I actually cut a fair bit out of Pete's email.
I had read it, and I'm like, oh, wait, this is confusing now.
So, yeah, the point of the setup there, obviously, is that even though Pete was extremely tired, he got super addicted to this game and played it for 14 hours.
14 hours.
As we discussed last week, or maybe a couple weeks ago, probably not a good idea to play a game for that long in one sitting. But clearly it shows that the game is addictive, and
the bigger issue is he'd been up for 36 hours.
Yeah, that's also a real bad idea.
That's a bad, cause at like 30, you start hallucinating and shit starts to get weird.
Yeah. I've been up for over 40 hours before, and, it's kind of terrifying. Actually, it's very deeply unpleasant.
Your brain starts to not work right.
I don't know. All of the hallucinating might cause a remix, if you will, of the game. But...
Oh. Yeah,
3D World Remix, yeah. That's coming up next spring, I'm sure.
It's coming out right before the next quarter announcement.
We'll get Super Luigi 3D World. And,
oh, dear God.
Oh, I would love that.
We already have that, really.
Yeah, so Pete's reference at the end was to the statement that John and I made last week during the emotional cleansing of the first segment, which was that I believe the exact phrasing was two people on a quote goddamn podcast about Nintendo that records weekly do not own Super Mario 3D World, and that's Nintendo's fault. End quote. And it's a true statement then, and it's still a true statement. As far as I know, John has not procured Super Mario 3D World, and nor have I. It's still Nintendo's fault that neither of us got excited for that game when it was announced, and they didn't really do anything to stoke the flames except for a Nintendo Direct that's easily missable. Because they do so many, it's no longer an event to watch them.
Yeah, I would agree that they've done a disservice to the game in not... I mean, they said almost nothing about it after E3 until right before it came out.
Except for that Nintendo Direct. And like I said, Nintendo Directs are easily missable. I haven't seen any advertising for the game.
It's part of the pitch.
I mean, I haven't seen those ads on TV, I mean.
Oh, yeah, I haven't either. I mean, I don't watch TV.
So, I mean, to me, my only real... Let me rephrase that sentence before I piss off Neil. My singular point of reference for the game is the fine content on Nintendo World Report. However, that does not... there's no easy way to answer this. That does not give Nintendo an excuse to not provide additional supplementary content to the fine output they no doubt know that we are creating.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean...
Good save!
Yeah, let me try to put that into English for you, James. I think they have depended almost entirely on the critical response to sell this game, and that is going to work on some people, and it's going to have little or no influence on a lot of other people. And
who don't follow the critical response to games.
Right, or don't trust it.
Which, let me point out, that includes myself.
Would it kill them to do a demo? I mean, they don't usually for a big game like this, but... you know, maybe they look at the attach rate and they say, whoa, we were hoping to sell to at least
half of
Wii U owners, so maybe we need to do something to reach out to them.
But to me, it's got nothing to do with the attach rate. It's that this is a game that they should be using to try to position the Wii U, and they're not doing either.
Doesn't seem like it. I mean, but then again, it's a Mario game, so they could come back in 6 months and be like, hey, there's this new Mario game most of you haven't played. And
hey, we just released this 6 months ago, guys. I actually responded to Pete on Twitter. While I'm sure it's a great game, and I know John's sort of the same mind, at the moment we have other things we're doing. And, you know, I explicitly said I was waiting for somebody
you know, Amazon or Best Buy or somebody to do one of those crazy buy two, get one free deals for Wii U games, and it just didn't materialize this year, which is weird because it did before Thanksgiving.
Maybe Boxing Day or something like that. There usually are some deals right after Christmas.
That stuff's still going to roll around. And, you know, I'll get cash or gift cards for Christmas. So for me, there's no real reason to go drop 60 of my own dollars on a game I'm not super hyped for. I mean, for Nintendo to get 60 out of me really, really easily, it would have to be like Ogre Battle 3. I mean, which I've actually probably paid at least $80-$90 for in my entire life at some point. So
you are very deal conscious. So
I am.
That's a fair point.
So it's just, you know, they never got me amped up enough for me to go, okay, here's my money. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm not just going to hand it over to them without them making the effort, I think. It's not like a personal, like, screw you guys. It's just kind of you know, for me to be there on day one, I kind of need to be pushed out my door.
Yeah, and I actually felt that way about 3D Land when that game first came out on 3DS. I'm a little more influenced by critical reception. I'm more likely to pick up on someone else's recommendation probably. And so for me, that game, I don't even think I got that the day it came out. I think it's been a while back, but I want to say it was maybe a week later. But when I did, I really, really enjoyed it. I think that'll be the case for you, James, and John,
sure,
as well.
Be.
But especially knowing how much you like 3D Land, I think, you know, I agree with you that it's Nintendo's fault if they couldn't get you hyped up for this game. But it's also their fault that they made a fantastic Mario game. And I think you will definitely enjoy it and fully appreciate it once you do play it.
And to me, the reason that the hype is the problem is that I will appreciate that game if I play it now. Or if I play it in 2015. Mm-hmm. So if they want this game to sell early, they need to do something to make me buy it.
So did Nintendo really kind of shoot themselves in the foot by making the Miiverse what it is instead of just giving people Twitter or something like that, direct Twitter integration? You know, unless I'm on the Miiverse, I'm not really seeing that much Miiverse content. And if all the conversation about Nintendo games is on the Miiverse, then only people who are currently playing Wii U games and now 3DS games are you even going to see it.
There's not that much conversation about Mario on Miiverse. It's mostly people like drawing little cartoons with those stamps, which is compelling and will probably convince some people to pick up the game, but it's not really critical discussion of the game itself.
I have 7 devices in my house that I can tweet from.
Sure.
I don't need another one.
I really appreciate having a completely separate sort of a social network for my gaming and in the way that Miiverse is used. You know, I have Twitter connections that are personal, you know, gaming connections, but also a lot of professional connections, and I don't want to spam all of my followers with video games.
No,
game
of
stuff,
course.
You know?
Yeah, well, my point was just that I think it kind of, you know, ghettoizes Nintendo talk in a way, you know?
Oh, like absolutely.
People are talking. I do appreciate the fact that the Miiverse is just about Nintendo, but at the same time, I'm maybe tweeting less about the games that I'm playing, and I'll just be, okay, well, I'll just post the screenshot here, and it's pretty cool, and only people who are following me on Miiverse are going to see it, you know? And not just me, but other people, you know? Like, I'm kind of wondering, is the absence of people just saying, like, holy shit, Super Mario 3D World is awesome on my Twitter feed, is that due to the Miiverse?
I think people are still saying it, though. I mean, I use the Miiverse and Twitter for completely different things. Mm-hmm. I never try to get across an idea on Miiverse. On Miiverse, I'm just either taking an image and going, look at this shit right here. Or I'm...
Look at my shit.
Or I'm putting in a comment. I did one for NES Remix where there's a particularly egregiously difficult level. And I just surrounded Donkey Kong in bombs is one of the stamps. And I basically said, there's not enough bombs in the world to punish you for this level or something along those lines. It's just me being kind of goofy and just doing silly stuff. Whereas on Twitter, if I'm talking about a game, it's going to be a much more serious endeavor because I'm trying to.
Well, you're also using words.
Yeah.
It's just that I think that for the first time, I'm realizing now that, you know, like the whole streaming and Twitch thing that Sony is doing, it is really smart because you want people to see other people play your games and, you know, like, look at how much fun I'm having.
Including people who don't own PS4. You know, they sure, don't own yeah. the device that the content originates from. And that is part of the problem with Miiverse, for sure.
You know, the people who are already engaging with the product that see how much fun I'm having, if they care at all. And the rest of the world at large just continues on ignoring completely that the Wii U is a thing, you know?
You have to imagine this is part of the logic of putting Miiverse on 3DS, is that it
Yeah, and they've opened it up since, you know, on the internet since then, and that's a good move. But maybe they could do more.
I think it's really smart. I think they're trying to develop something more like an ecosystem, you know, to get to get people kind of locked into Nintendo. I don't think it's working very well for them.
No, I don't think it's working, but I get the idea behind it. I mean, part of the problem is that you know, people aren't necessarily talking about games on Miiverse, and that's why I kind of question its value as a word of mouth thing. You know, Guillaume, you talked about you put something up there and that only the people who follow you can see it. I would argue that probably a lot of the people who follow you still won't see it because
yeah,
people
absolutely.
Don't necessarily open Miiverse and go into their activity feed.
I don't.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So as Miiverse is better integrated into games like really both of the Mario games, I think it's integrated very nicely, and it sounds like it is with the NES remakes too. But it becomes a thing that you don't actually have to leave the game to use. And that actually has pros and cons to it, because it means that you're no longer really so much a consumer of other people's posts. You're just a generator. And I think you can see that with 3D World. You've got people who, they go in there and they set up these, you know, sometimes very goofy and minimalist or sometimes very elaborate, illustrations using all the stamps. And then you can take out the pen or maybe you even type some things into it. But you're really spending all your time making posts and not looking at other people's posts. And in fact, the stream of Miiverse posts that go by every time you beat a level, they're just from random people. I don't think those are necessarily filtered for your friends or anything. So it becomes not really a two-way communication anymore. And it certainly doesn't become a way for you to talk about the games you're playing with your friends. It just becomes a way for you to draw a silly picture. And maybe some people see it and maybe they don't. But
yeah.
It's a very different than Twitter, where you can throw something out there, and if it's not in the middle of the night, there's a very good chance that most of the people who follow you are gonna see that.
Are gonna at least scroll over it when they go past.
Right. And then they can sort of filter it mentally, what do I want to read this and follow through on it or not. But I think Miiverse is, you know, I don't think people pay attention to what their friends are doing on Miiverse in the same way that people do on Twitter. And that's partly because of the design of Miiverse itself. You know, that's the way it's set up. So, you know, I think, you know, I enjoy it, and I think there's some really interesting uses of it, but I don't know, at least so far, that it's a good, like, social marketing tool.
Johnny, do you think they could, benefit from more like community management, get more people into Miiverse, showing others how to use it? In a way, you know, encouraging the different kinds of things that you're talking about, more starting more discussions, things like that.
Well, I don't know if, I mean, it begs the question, is Miiverse the correct place to even do that kind of, that sort of training and leading by example? You know, I mean, if, I don't know, you know, I mean, you do have the announcements like you get from Tom, but those are usually kind of patch notes about, hey, we updated Miiverse. Now it does this. We moved this thing. We took away that feature. You know, maybe you can use that same tool to kind of give, you know, show people examples and that sort of forces it in front of them a little better. But, I think that's not quite what you're proposing, right? So to have these sort of leaders within the community who kind of show people how to use features or maybe set a good example. Again, I don't really know that Miiverse really right now is set up for you to even discover that kind of tool. And I don't know how effective that could be. It's an interesting idea.
I think Nintendo has really always been about selling an experience. You know, all of their games sort of have a central design aesthetic that sets it apart from stuff that other companies make. So to tie everything together with Miiverse and to get the Miis, you know, across platforms now, I think they have a real opportunity to start to put something, you know, more, I don't know, Apple like together, rather than just coloring their consoles white and so on. But the real like vertical integration that they have going, where they're really getting people to buy into an experience. And
I mean, certainly they have built up this kind of corporate identity for the interface, and I think that's what you're getting at. And they've done it really kind of piece by piece. It's happened over time, and you might not have even realized it. But now we've got, like you said, Mii's across both systems, which is kind of this user profile system that also does some. It does a lot when you're playing local games, but it can also be tied in with online games in some cases. You've got a messaging system and a friend system, a social network system that potentially could tie into the way you play online multiplayer games, although we have very few examples of that so far, but potentially it could be used for that. You know, you've even got a unified digital store front now where they're both called eShop and they look similar and they work similarly, and now they even use the same currency finally. So they've, mm-hmm. they've very slowly, like you said, done the vertical integration to kind of make this a very familiar experience. And the nice thing about that is if you learn how to use one system, it's easy to learn how to use the other system. And so, like you said, with Apple, it makes sense in that, you know, it kind of gets people used to using these kinds of products. It gets them, you know, they're used to finding certain features in certain parts of the interface, and then they go to their friend's house and play Xbox and it's not there, and they get frustrated with that, and they say, well, I'm just going to stick with Nintendo. I mean, they could lead to that, I guess, but I'm kind of doubtful that we're going to see that go the way that Apple did. But at least the potential is there now that they've done all that work. And I think it makes the whole thing more pleasant at the very least. Yeah, Mario really is great. And
I guess.
You'll hear James and John talk about it at some point.
I still haven't finished the final stage. I'm so ashamed.
Oh, it sounds.
I think I've decided to not go for it. I'm gonna have to
double get good you people in one episode. That's terrible.
I just don't think it's worth spending that much time. I beat all the levels that you can play without having to go back through and collect every fucking little thing. I found that process tedious and not rewarding in 3D Land, and I don't think I'm going to bother going through it on 3D World. I got lots of mileage out of this game. I don't need to go back and torture myself by trying to get the gold flag on every single level. You know, the final unlock thing is just catered a little bit too much towards completionism for my taste. And I, you know, at my age and with the kind of appetite for a broad set of games that I have, I just can't afford to be completionist anymore. And I've fallen out of the habit of it. So I think I'm going to pass on that stuff. But I'm very, very happy with the amount of content that I got and the level of challenge towards the end. You know, I really like it. So we'll have plenty of other chances to talk about it. But Dave, you didn't get a whole lot of chance to talk about 3D World. Is there anything else you want to say? Because I know you've been playing it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have anything to add that hasn't really been said. I think it's an amazing game. I'm one of these people that will probably buy every mainline Mario game that's ever released. You know, I'm part of the problem. I admit it.
It's not a problem. It's a good problem to have.
No, yeah, but it's not. But we had two.
Debatable.
We had two new Super Mario Brothers within 3 months of each other. It's not a good problem.
And I ate it up.
You know? Yeah.
That's the bridge just being washed away by the tides.
I'm probably the worst part of the problem because I complained about it, but I still bought and played them both. So I'm really trying to have my cake and eat it too.
But I really love the game. I'm stuck on the boss rush level right now. For some reason, I just cannot finish that in time. And I just
can't. Well, because it's a bastard of a level, and it's terrible. I hate that level.
No, it's great. Pro tip, you can jump from one snake to the other.
I guess all of the events, like things that happen that seem like they would be random, are not. And you can sort of just memorize where everything goes, and it works pretty well. So when the snakes pop up, that's a programmed sequence.
Right. Yeah, I don't care for that kind of challenge, but I made it through.
Okay,
that.
Well, don't get NES Remix then. Like, it's seriously, it's exactly different. No, it's like the whole bus rush spirit is, you know, NES Remix.
A bit.
Like you want to do this one simple task really perfectly, you know, and then you do a string of simple tasks perfectly, and you're trying to get the best score possible.
Oh, sure. No, my biggest problem with Boss Rush is that it asks you to do about 100 things in a row perfectly, and the whole sequence takes 6 minutes. So if you mess up at any point along the way, you might not even realize it until 4 minutes later, and that's when you realize you have to start all over again. And by that time, you may not even really know what you did wrong. So it's a bad structure. It's a bad level.
No, if
you chop that up into small pieces and say, beat this one boss and you have 45 seconds, go, that would be different. And that sounds a lot more like NES Remix, right?
No, yeah, you're right.
Okay. All right. So why don't we move on to the next letter? And actually, Guillaume, you're going to read this one.
All right. Arrow.
Like, fuck. Like the acrobat. If you like played that dumb game.
Arrow writes, back at the start of November, you had a section on the podcast where you discussed your favorite Halloween games. Now that we're getting close to the holiday season, I was wondering if you had any favorite Christmas or winter themed games, or even just levels. Personally, I always make the effort to play through that Christmas themed stage in Elite Beat Agent around Christmas. And the Snow Mountain area in Xenoblade Chronicles was incredible to explore at night when I was playing that game around this time last year. It would be great to hear your responses. Thank you for churning out such a great podcast week after week.
Ooh. Thank you, Arrow.
I find it really difficult. Like, even Halloween themed games, I can't put myself in the mindset of playing scary games for a whole month before Halloween. And I don't think that playing Christmas themed games during Christmas really makes sense to me.
I can see what you're saying. I don't tend to pick up a game seasonally. I mean, sometimes if it's like a spooky game, I don't have anything to do on Halloween, maybe. But that's really just in the same spirit. I would watch whatever garbage AMC is debasing the word classics with on Halloween that year. It's weird to pick up Christmas games, though, because not a lot of games, especially once they went 3D, use winter as a setting, because winter is harder to render with snow.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Although we do have like probably one of the best... I don't know. To me, it's a classic level, the first snow level in Super Mario 64. But if I'm playing Super Mario 64, it's because I want to be playing Super Mario 64, probably, right? Because I just played some other Mario game, and I'm just like, oh, wow, you know what? I want to play more Mario.
And they get around the snow by just making the texture white on everything.
Yeah, but you
it's
know.
It's not like, really they're snow. It's just like a whiteout world.
True, but you've got penguins. You've got slides. You've got...
The music is very Christmassy also.
Yeah, you've got the jingle bells. It's perfect.
And by the way, 3D World has an amazing winter themed level, and the music is absolutely glorious and sounds much more like actual Christmas music. I mean, that is a song that completely works outside of the game, and you could probably hear it on the radio or like on a commercial during Christmas time. It so perfectly fits the season.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought you were going to say the very beginning of Metal Gear Solid Twin Snakes.
It's a okay. Nuclear apocalypse Christmas.
No, it's you're outside and the ground is covered in snow, and
he's there to
you
stop,
can see your tracks.
He's
and,
there to stop former special forces turned terrorists from destroying the world with nukes.
Well, you know, Die Hard is a Christmas movie too.
There you go. To me, the most Christmassy game, and this is going to sound like such a cop out, but I can defend it, is Animal Crossing.
Well, yeah.
I mean, they do all the winter, but they also have all these Christmas themed events going on. They do New Year's in a really fun way.
And right now there's some sort of snowman bingo or something going on.
They really do up the week between Christmas and New Year's. And, you know, all the people in town are talking about this stuff. I think there's at least three festivals in December.
Yeah.
It's an amusing sort of Christmassy spirit. It's probably the closest thing to a Christmas themed costume quest that there is. Although it's just a subset of a larger game.
Sounds like something for Dave and I to look forward to.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you guys, can you think of any like actual truly Christmas-themed games at all, or even
I think it's just hard to set a game at Christmas, and not that it's, I mean, rephrase that, it's hard to explicitly set a game at Christmas.
Based on movies that were set at Christmas, I guess, but that's, I don't think that's really the,
yeah, you can go play Home Alone for the Game Boy, but I wouldn't advise it. It's terrible.
There is a Nightmare Before Christmas video game as well.
There is. Okay. Is that good?
Yeah, there's a few of those.
That probably isn't.
There's actually a pretty good Nightmare Before Christmas game on Wii, on GBA. It's kind of a Metroid style thing, but it's also, in that game in particular, much more Halloween themed than Christmas.
Yeah,
themed.
That was that weird Second Life for the franchise that came in the middle 2000s.
It was a spinoff thing, right?
The thing is, setting a movie at Christmas, there's lots of them that do it, but for the most part, it's just a flavoring on some other plot archetype that they've already sort of put into a film.
Well, or unless it's specifically like some Santa Claus, you know, Christmas movie.
Right, yeah. I mean, unless it's like...
There aren't really any Santa Claus video games, I guess is the point.
No, Elf Bowling.
Yeah, I actually went to like really cheap like PC freeware crap. I think there was like a Santa Claus platformer that we used to play on our computer back in the 90s.
Oh, dear Lord.
And there's a I want to say there's a Christmas themed version of James Pond for Genesis.
I believe you are correct.
I'm not hallucinating that, am I? I think I played it.
One of the Donkey Kong Country games has something Christmas themed, don't they? I want to say it's 3. I want to say there's like a Christmas themed level in there.
I think you're right, because I'm seeing Kitty Kong wearing a sort of a Santa Claus hat. Anyway, it's like bits and pieces, but I mean, that's definitely not that whole game. But actually, I'm glad you brought up Donkey Kong Country 3, because I was going to mention just a quick Christmas story. I remember...
Clay Fighter 63 and a third. There you go.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Santa Claus is a
Merry
character
Christmas.
In that.
Wow.
But I was going to mention that Christmas of 96, the year N64 came out, I had my N64 back in September when it was launched, and I had asked for a couple of games. I think I got Cruisin' USA and Killer Instinct Gold for Christmas. I already had Mario.
Yeah, we've talked about this. Wolf.
Yeah, and the game that I played the most that Christmas was a Super Nintendo game, Donkey Kong Country 3, which also came out that winter. And I remember that was the game that I couldn't put down, even with my shiny new N64 games. Of course, they weren't the greatest N64 games, but
you could put down Cruisin' USA, amazing.
Yeah, wow.
It's more a matter of you didn't just slam it to the ground and go, no.
No, I mean, you have to remember that was a technical showcase at the time. It was a very well-known arcade game.
Oh, I know.
And Cruisin' USA was, we played it a lot, and a lot of my friends wanted to come over and check it out because they were really impressed by the visuals, and it was a familiar touch point for them. So I remember showing Cruisin' USA to lots of people and them being like really into it, and we played it a lot. So... It was what we had at the time.
Times were tough back then.
We can't go through this topic without mentioning that there was a Nights into Dreams version, a Christmas version of that game.
Right.
If you owned a Sega Saturn, which you shouldn't.
Yeah, I don't understand what the logic was there, like if a lot of people bought it, because it was the same game,
it was
right?
A CD that was in things like Sega Saturn Magazine, which is the most hilarious magazine in the world. It came with pretty much every Saturn game at one point, and was included in a Christmas-themed Sega Saturn bundle, also known as Lump of Coal Edition. Hmm. Oh, and they just gave it away for free at places, too, just for fun.
Okay, so it was a giveaway.
Yeah.
Pac-Man Versus.
If Nintendo gamers want to get some Christmas cheer right now, Wii Fit You, play any game that takes place in on the Wu Island, and all the trees are lit up, and there's snow everywhere, and it's beautiful.
That's right. I tried orienteering a few days ago, and I noticed that.
Which
I thought that was
such a weird
neat.
We Fit You game.
Yes, it is. It's very weird.
I don't think of fitness and mapping.
Well, as you're not really mapping, I know. It's more like it's kind of like geocaching, but you're just looking for your friends. In Mii form, it's not that great. Actually, it's not one of my favorite.
I don't know. You learn the geography of a fictional island, which can come in handy, right?
Well, I did that already in Wii Sports Resort, and I thought it was a lot more fun when I was in an airplane flying over it.
Yeah, we were just flying over, like, oh, there it is.
Yeah. As it turns out, Woohoo Island, not the most interesting place when you're on foot and free roaming it. There's not actually that much going on there.
Even doing it by bicycle, which they did in, was that the first Wii Fit game?
It was in Wii Fit Plus. Now take that and divide the speed by about 3.
Oh, no.
And that's what orienteering feels like.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
That sounds terrible.
It's not that great. But anyway, yeah, no, that's a good point. So, you know, a lot of things kind of go into a Christmas theme, and you know, that's kind of nice. I actually think Arrow's suggestion in the email of Elite Beat Agents playing that one level, I mean, that's the best level in that game, and it's very, very Christmas themed.
It's very sad. It's like,
yeah, it's pretty great. So that's probably the best idea of any, better than anything we've come up with.
It's if you pass it, but just barely pass it, you can have a sad Christmas. it's the darkest Elite Beat Agents chapter if you do badly.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It totally is. Yeah, that's a
really
inspired
section. Even if you don't do badly, it's the darkest. But if you do badly, it's the darkest.
Yeah, and now I'm thinking about how much I wish there was a new Elite Beat Agents, and I'm sad. Thanks.
This is another service we
Thanks,
offer.
Thanks, Arrow, and also James.
Innis is busy making lips,
All
too.
All right, so why don't we move on? Why don't we move on to the next email, and Dave's going to read that one.
Okay. Joshua writes, I have been following the Twitter conversation about Iwata's status as Nintendo's CEO after the Wii U sales have become public. There seems to be a consensus that his job is in jeopardy and that it is no longer an if, but a when. I disagree with the knee-jerk reaction that Iwata is done and is going to be terminated, or should. Sure, Wii U sales have been disappointing, maybe even abysmal. But given the past success of Wii, DS, and now the 3DS, I find it hard to believe that Iwata will be fired over one bungled product. It would be like Steve Jobs being ousted from Apple because the Apple TV, a product they barely care about, didn't sell as well as the iPhone, iPad, or iPod. Maybe there is something about Japanese culture that I don't comprehend that may come into play here. Or maybe Iwata will step down in shame, Itoi style. But demanding Iwata's head seems so out of place, especially in 2013, the quote, year of the 3DS, unquote.
The year of Luigi.
So I
There will be no executions in the year of Luigi.
It's a banquet year. It's a festival year.
Which is why Iwata is pushing it into 2014.
It will be extended.
I don't know if you can...
But
I feel like the 3DS is succeeding in spite of Iwata in some ways.
I think... Well, part of it is we go back to the statement we made back when they named Iwata as CEO of Nintendo of America. Which is, we don't really necessarily know what Iwata's role is in the company. With Yamauchi, there was enough reporting about what he does. Basically, he lets you present a game and goes, no, shit, get out. Or, yeah, make it. It's fine. And we sort of had a feel for what his role as chief executive of the company was. For Iwata, I'm not sure it's totally clear what his role and responsibilities are. And if that's the case, it may not make it totally clear on whose head entirely the Wii U weighs.
Right. I think we covered this somewhat a couple months ago when we had a broader discussion about Iwata. I think it was maybe back around the 10-year anniversary of him taking over.
I think it was the CEO thing when they made him CEO of Nintendo of America.
And that's right. That's when it was. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. We were trying to figure out exactly what the hell he does right now anyway.
Yeah. And I think one thing that came up at the time was that, you know, even though we have a lot more access to Iwata than we ever did to Yamauchi, and he's out there on the directs, he's also doing the Iwata Asks interviews, and you get a lot of direct.
Well, and he does interviews. I mean, he does press interviews too, which Yamauchi never did.
Right, and he gets up in front of the investors and directly, you know, answers questions
from
people.
I mean, he talks at E3.
Right, so, you know, far more accessible, and yet I don't get the sense that – I don't know how assertive he is, you know. I don't know how much direct control he has. I mean, I think the persona that he projects is that he's kind of this funny, wacky, creative – person who maybe suggests things to people. You know, he maybe filters ideas to some extent, but he doesn't have that reputation of being the authoritative, you know, hand of justice that Yamauchi was. And so, you know, you have to wonder, are these decisions being made more by committee at this point, with Iwata as sort of a, not a figurehead, but as more of a spiritual leader? Or is he more of the, you know, Steve Jobs, my way or the highway kind of guy who's making these decisions and really is carrying the entire company on his shoulders? I don't know.
So, you know, we had an email a couple months ago where somebody pointed out that Iwata has quietly been, you know, reverse palace cooing the board of directors, and his people have sort of been filling positions.
Like a ninja.
Yes. Normally, when board of directors change that much, it's a relatively big thing. In this case, it has been very, very quiet. And you may think board of directors is sort of this abstract business thing, but I would say at least, you know, five or six people who sit on the board, that's their singular job, whereas most people are more advisory positions.
Mm-hmm.
My guess, based on what they have said publicly, and it's usually what Iwata says in interviews, what comes up, you know, when he's talking about when stuff fell onto his desk during he's doing an Iwata ask, and he says, well, that's when I saw the game. A lot of times it's relatively early in the development, and he kind of replays some sort of dialogue he maybe had with somebody. A lot of times it's him discussing what he and Miyamoto talked about when a game wound up inside of his headlights. So my guess, and this is just guess, is that those two probably are more on the creative side, and there's probably a third person who does the business stuff. And that's really not that unusual in a corporation of that size, where there is a person who doesn't care what the product is. They are a business hound, and that is their job. Yeah. And they're not the public face. They're just back there crunching the numbers. They usually have a title like managing director or something like that, senior managing director. And their job is just the money, the business, you know, all that kind of stuff.
So, I mean, ultimately, he is the CEO, though. And
he is the CEO, and, which means effectively the buck stops with him. But in reality, it probably stops with the heirs to the Yamauchi family. Hmm. So, ultimately, I believe, I'm not 100% sure.
They would be the people on the board to some extent, or at least they're the investors.
They nominate members to the board, yes.
Yeah, the investors have representation on the board. And you know, we're not going to get into like corporate politics here too much, but, you know, my sense from films such as Spider-Man and Iron Man is that the CEO is typically is very much at the mercy of the board and can very much be overthrown by the board if they don't like the way things are going. James, I look to you as sort of our expert on Japanese business practices.
Yes.
You get the sense that could happen in this case?
So the board, like I said, the board appears to be a lot of people. So it is, to a certain extent, it would have to be a palace coup. But it is my understanding, and this may not be accurate, is that the Yamauchi family still controls 50% plus one or more of Nintendo stock, which means ultimately they have the power to put people on the board. So if they decided they wanted to sack Iwata, they'd probably sack the board first. Mm. So we'd probably know it's coming.
Yeah.
They'd probably, you know, eradicate the current board and replace them with people who would then out Iwata.
And I wonder if he is more vulnerable now that Yamauchi is gone. I mean, you could get the sense that he might have been protected by Yamauchi for at least for a while because he was Yamauchi's choice to succeed himself. And so therefore, you know, maybe he would have the backing of the former president. And maybe now that Yamauchi has passed away, he's looking at, you know, that guy's kids and grandkids who maybe don't have the affinity for Iwata.
Perhaps, but now there's also sort of a, it's not one person can just wake up one morning and go, oh, get rid of him.
All have to be working in concert. But if they're all family members, that certainly is possible.
It is. So in Japanese corporate culture, you can sort of look to what happened with the Virtual Boy. It's kind of an informative event. So to recap what Guillaume has spoke about on the show, Gunpei Yokoi was instrumental in a lot of the technological decisions Nintendo made early in its transition into the video games, culminating in his sort of being considered the father figure of the Game Boy product line. Mm-hmm. So that's he sort of helped push them in the electronic gaming business. Whereas, you know, Miyamoto is sort of viewed as their early progenitor. He was writing the software that was running on Gunpei Yokoi's machines. So he's a very important figure in the early Nintendo, in the early Nintendo mafia, if you want to use that phrase. But
I wouldn't have, but okay.
His first post Game Boy product is the Virtual Boy. Now, what form the Virtual Boy was supposed to ultimately take, I've heard that there are versions of it that were more sophisticated, that weren't red, they were like multicolor, that didn't cause the headaches. I've heard that, there were some more mock-ups, but ultimately the product that he settled on, in part because of cost considerations, is the Virtual Boy that we know and love. And I use that term relatively loosely. And it was a colossal failure. Absolutely stratospheric collapse to earth for his career. They didn't fire him. They didn't eradicate him. They did what they corner officed him, which is the term in Western business culture. Getting a corner office is great. In Japanese business culture, it means they're putting you far away from where the decisions are being made.
They've essentially made your position ceremonial.
Yeah, they've moved you to the end of the hall. So it would be unusual for them to just completely shoot Iwata out of a cannon, out of the company altogether. If something were to happen, it would be that Iwata would make the decision to take a new title. And that title may sound grandiose or important, but he ultimately wouldn't be the CEO. Or they would have somebody come up to sort of fill the business rank of the CEO's job, and he just holds the title as a figurehead.
And then, what happens to him might depend on his loyalty to the company or his willingness to go along with that. Or, maybe he's the kind of guy, much like Yokoi was, where he's like, look, I gotta keep making stuff. It's in my blood. That's what I do. I can't stay here and quietly retire and collect a paycheck, a pension, just because I don't want to disgrace the company. And so in Yokoi's case, he left and started doing stuff for Bandai, and he designed the Wonder Swan and the Wonder Swan Color. And he did other things. I don't know if Iwata would do that. Like, would Iwata go and, work for Sony?
My guess is all the stuff he's doing that's more related to the games end of the business, he would probably still be doing. It's probably more the high level, this is our idea for the console. Do we do it? Are you going to fund it? That decision may fall out of his hands. That may end up being a board vote if they just want to make this more of a more eyes on it, or there could be somebody else who has to go, yeah, I'm on board, let's do this.
I don't think he would get kutaragi'd.
No, I think it would be, again, Sony's business culture isn't the standard Japanese business culture because it's run more like a gang war than it is a company.
And they've also had foreign CEOs.
It was basically everybody was sharpening their knives to stab Howard Stringer, but ultimately they were sharpening them on each other. So Sony's business culture was a mess. I mean, it was a mess. I don't know that it still is.
Yeah.
My gut feeling, because I've spoken pretty much at length, is that Iwata is not in immediate danger. My guess is that the company, as long as the company remains overall on a profitable trajectory, that is to say that it can have quarters where it loses money, it can even have years where it loses some amount of money, Iwata's situation is probably not dire as long as it remains generally profitable. There are some economic
factors. They're going to want to see him take corrective actions and...
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm sure he's working on that. And my guess is that he's probably not the only person at the senior level who is working on that. There's probably a crisis response team, and he may not even be on it. He may be reviewing their reports. Ultimately,
yeah,
there are
some... an independent, study group.
And they just come to him. The president doesn't sit on presidential commissions. He just reviews their reports and makes decisions.
Yeah, NASA has independent commissions who study, if there's a big disaster, they bring in outside people and they kind of give them a certain amount of independence so that the people who made the mistakes don't necessarily influence.
Oh yeah, because that was a big deal during the Challenger.
Blame and corrective action.
The Challenger disaster was a big example of why you have to have an empowered, independent commission.
Absolutely.
That,
Yeah.
That whole thing was a mess even before the thing attempted to launch. Ultimately, though, there are some economic conditions, some macroeconomic conditions that work for Iwata's favor. The Japanese government has, the Japanese central bank has engaged in extraordinary levels of quantitative easing to cause the yen to devalue significantly versus
foreign
currency.
Whoa, my brain just exploded.
Basically,
quantitative easing?
What is they've basically been printing yen at a rate that is staggering. Remember, just a couple years ago, the yen was about 80 yen to the dollar, whereas now it's back to that rough figure of 100 to the dollar. Yeah. This means that all Nintendo's foreign earnings, which is the majority of their earnings, coming back into Japan, are now worth more yen than they were 2 or 3 years ago. In fact, Japan was trying so hard to devalue the yen, which sounds weird, but remember, they're mostly an export economy. They were trying so hard to devalue the yen that the other developed economies got, especially the ones in the G8, were really coming down on them to stop because it had gotten out of hand.
And we just dropped the G8 reference. So
we did.
I think we might have gotten a little too deep, James.
By the way, but my point is, for Iwata, this is good because remember, a lot of times they talk about in their investor statements, the yen has become so valuable that our foreign business is dragging us down. Now that's not an issue. They can slash the price of the Wii by 20%, or the Wii U, by about 20%, and ultimately make the same amount of yen on it when they convert it to their home nation currency.
Okay, so you think he has some wiggle room?
He does, and there's improving economy in the developing world, which will allow for the more purchases of discretionary income purchases like video game consoles. There you go. And additionally, the Wii U attach rate isn't bad. I want to say it's about 3 games per console. And I want to say the figure is 2 for them to do a slight profit on the console at the current moment. So I think ultimately he's not in a dire situation. And there, even with the Wii U's bad sales figures, there are things that will help keep Nintendo in a generally profitable trajectory, which I think is the only criterion he needs to meet in order to keep his job.
Sure.
Even if his job does get changed slightly to give some more people voice in the decision process. By the way, I'm regarded as the reactionary one, and I just dropped economics all over this bitch. So
I feel educated. I really
there you
do.
Go.
That was I feel out of my depth right now, frankly.
Boom.
I'm hungry.
Why don't we just move on from that? Because I don't even feel educated. I don't even feel informed enough to respond to what James just dropped on us.
I'm sure some economics major is going to get really mad. Like, no, you got it all wrong.
We're going to have to end the show here. That we just had too much fun with macroeconomics and other topics.
It's important information.
It is. No, I'm seriously impressed, James. But we are going to wrap it up here. So, of course, if you would like us to answer your email or talk about anything on the show, please send those ideas to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Wanted to let everybody know we're planning currently to take off next week for New Year's. I can't say for sure that we won't have anything, but right now we expect that we will be taking the week off. We'll be coming back in the new year in 2014. Very soon we're going to be doing our top 5 games of the year.
Oh, God.
Which has been a recent tradition. And I've enjoyed the format that we came up with. It's very simple. It's very personal. We've had a large variety of games come up over the past couple of years. I like it this way. So we're going to be throwing our list together for that, after the holidays, once we've all had a chance to catch up on a few things, over the break. And then of course, probably towards the end of January or maybe into February, we will be scheduling the F-Zero Retroactive. So I know the break will be an opportunity for me to catch up on those games. I did just buy a GameCube.
Nice.
That was a fun experience. I'm all set up for GX now, and I'm also planning to bring back my N64 from home so I can play F-Zero X, since the damn Wii mode on Wii U won't let me download it from the shop channel. That's a Wait. That's a fiasco for another day. But I will be playing both of them, and I know, it's a long story. I hope a lot of you will be playing F-Zero over the holidays, and we'll be getting ready for Retroactive soon. So that's it for the show. Before we go, thank you very much, Dave Mellert, for being our guest on this episode. And any content plans coming up on the website that we can look forward to? Your dissertation?
Yeah, look me up on Google Scholar and download some of my papers. No, I
there okay. you go, done.
That's yeah. the best plug we've ever had.
yes, no, I have nothing to plug on the site. I've mostly just been doing editing, and I had to take a little bit of a break due to work schedule. So I actually don't know exactly what's going on with features right now.
All right. So we really do appreciate you being on here, Dave, and hopefully we'll get to talk to you another time. But that is going to be the end of the episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening. Have a great holiday break. I hope you get to play lots of video games, and we'll be back here in a couple of weeks in 2014.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. They showed some people playing it, but they didn't actually, like, say a whole hell of a lot about it.
No.
Like, they're just like, here's some stuff. It's got, like, things from your favorite NES games, which is a lie, because almost none of those games are anyone's favorite NES games. And they're like, oh, and it's out now. Go get it. And I'm just thinking to myself, the hell just happened? I'm like, oh, yeah, and Wii Sports Club Golf's out now, too. We finally got that stupid thing with the golf ball on the gamepad. And you're just like, oh my God, what are you doing right now?
Promise delivered 2.5 years later.
So I would call this Nintendo Direct the, oh my God, what are you doing right now? I'm so confused. Am I awake right now, Nintendo Direct?
Wasn't there also some kind of announcement about like a Zelda Dynasty Warriors or something?
There was
like
a Zelda Dynasty Warriors, which is a game that I called for on this show half a decade ago. So Nintendo's listening, just really, really behind.
Someone make a YouTube clip of James predicting this, like, you know, back in 2007 or whatever.
Oh my God,
I don't
even remember what the context was that I called. It wasn't even like a prediction segment, just like, you know, what would be really cool? A Zelda game that focused on fighting big armies of enemies.
Oh man, that's going to be a needle in the haystack to go find
Greg
that.
Knows where it is. Greg's listening right now.
Yeah, we should just ask Greg.
He's like, that's 174 at 3821. Fucking unbelievable. Greg,
he's
email
so,
the show and
so
tell us. We miss you. What was really bizarre, though, is that this thing's just rolling on. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there that was legitimate new announcements. That's always surprising.
Totally, yeah. I mean, anytime you find out about a new game that you've never heard of before, that's pretty cool. You know? I mean,
especially it's out right now. Go get it.
Well, yeah, because you really don't know what to expect, and it's fun to get those things out of nowhere. I mean, who would predict that they would announce a new game or even multiple games the week before Christmas?
And release one of them as they announced it.
Right.
Get them those sweet holiday sales.
The Zelda Musou is interesting. I want to see more of that game because, I mean, it's obviously a pretty early build. I'm a little surprised they went with the Skyward Sword enemy design, but nothing else. That's a little curious.
Yeah, but, it just looks like Dynasty Warriors environments and characters from Zelda.
It's more colorful than Dynasty Warriors environments. Those tend to be pretty dark affairs.
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, it's Link's crossbow training with a sword, right?
No. It's much less than that.
I've never actually even played a Dynasty Warriors
game. The thing is, I've not played a Dynasty Warriors proper, but I've played lots of spin-offs of it, and I've played Capcom's version of it, which is Sengoku Basara, which is amazing.
Because it's the dumbest
game on Wii, and I am including Disaster Day of Crisis.
And Sengoku Basara, whatever you said.
Sengoku
Basara. That's supposed to be like a pretty good version, right? Like, isn't it a different developer?
It's good. I mean, it's a Musou game. It's not gonna, you know, set the world
like
on
none
fire.
None of them are that much better or worse than any of the other ones.
It's
right?
Really the trappings that make them better or worse. And that right. game, I mean, it's
well
on the
in this
level,
case, I mean, Zelda might be the best trappings they've ever
right,
had.
On the level
they
of functional
well.
Gameplay, Sengoku Basara is probably the highest. You know, how the buttons work, combos, stuff like that, and customization options. But in terms of like the sheer insanity, bullshit, crazy. Oh my god, where am I right now? That game is nuts. That game is Asura's Wrath on meth nuts. I mean, it's super crazy. So it's wonderful.
Yeah, in case you've forgotten about that game, because it did kind of come and go very quickly and no one really played it. Sengoku Basara, we'll put a link in the show notes on the sidebar so you can go read a little bit more about that.
I wrote
maybe
a review
of
it, actually.
Of it.
It's crazy. There's a scene
fun
where
to
you
watch, at least.
There's a scene where you fight during a samurai war a giant flying robot. And nobody makes reference to the fact he's a robot. It's just they're just like, whatever. Screw it. It's fine. Oh, and he controls lightning. Yeah.
So we got a little bit off track there.
We did. This Nintendo Direct was
and
super...
I didn't intend for us to go through every single thing, but I just want to follow up an earlier point. We also found out that there's a new Yoshi's Island DLC level for Sonic Lost
World
on Wii
U. That was when I realized I may still be asleep.
Well, yeah, and that led to, I think, Scott Thompson tweeting that basically felt like he was in a fever dream, which is great. And it's something that I could hear James saying too. But just to get back to your emphasis, that it really was a very strange set of announcements. And
even like how they did it, like Iwata had crazier hand gestures than usual. It was just like there was nobody else. Usually there's some interview or some like talking to a developer. There was none of that. The only thing we got was Reggie arm wrestling a me version of himself.
Who won?
He did. He beat his me.
He arm wrestled his own me.
He did at the very end of the Nintendo Direct. Reggie
like,
arm
did
wrestled.
Did they show him doing mushrooms before that?
Yeah, and then he smiled to the camera.
Yes.
I wasn't gonna watch the video of this thing. I was just gonna go off the secondhand.
It's bizarre.
I might have to go watch this.
I mean, like,
okay, James. Let's talk about the game that you actually played.
NES Remix. It's also weird.